So we have a fantastic conversation set up for you today. I think it's going to go in a number of very, very different directions. If just the first 10 minutes getting prepared in the green room is any indication. So I think, Deborah, let's talk about Tim and why he's here and what we're up to, and let's go.
I first came across Tim, and I took a course of his called Parts of the Psyche. And I was so impressed because I don't know if others of you have come across the book Taming Your Gremlin, but I had read that book and a whole saboteur language had started to not work for me because it felt like it didn't fit quite right. And so when I came across Tim's course, it explained to me what was bothering me that I didn't quite understand about that language and that approach. So Tim has given me a different way of understanding internal systems, internal to our psyches. And of course, this is a lot of the work that we're doing with clients, especially now that more and more companies and organizations, the Institute of Coaching is putting a huge emphasis on mental health. So this to me feels like really relevant information that Tim's going to share with us today. So I'm really looking forward to Tim sharing some of his wisdom with us. So thank you for joining us from California, where it's very early in the morning. Over to you, Tim Kelly.
It is early here. It's true, Deborah.
And Tim doesn't get up early for just anyone. So
that's true. I don't.
Here's the thing I learned about Tim recently that I think will set the scene and help you understand better. Tim is one of those people at the age of 6 that was questioning the people in Sunday school that were teaching him things. He ended up in the military as a swabbing decks person after 3 years at MIT. Clearly better educated than most of the officers on the ship and certainly all of the enlisted men. So I suspect he has been a bit of a fish out of water or in a different place, many, many places in his career or ahead of things. So I think for me, that gives us some really interesting insight because people who have had those kinds of experiences have the intelligence, the gumption, the forethought to think differently and see things from a different place. And I always find that to be a fascinating conversation. So, Tim, you've done family systems.
Let me just say to that point that fitting in was never really an option until I created my own community. It wasn't going to happen. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, no, fair enough. I appreciate that. So you've done work in parts of the psyche, which I'm sure I could make up a definition of what that means, but I'd love to hear you talk about that. You've done internal family systems. What does that really mean? Does that have to do with families? Is that work? Is that career? And
set the record. Yeah. So I'm actually trained in voice dialogue and not internal family systems therapy, but I'm a fan of internal family systems therapy. And I can explain a little bit about it. So let me just say what I mean by parts, first of all. So thinking of the psyche as composed of parts is a model. And I'm a big fan of the George Box quote, all models are wrong, some are useful. So
yes, we like that too.
Right. So we're gonna take one of those lenses and look at the psyche through that lens, but try not to get seduced into believing that the lens is the truth and the model is the truth and what it reveals is the truth, right? So let me just, a bias of mine. If you think about a car, that's singular, one car. If you're a mechanic, you don't think about it as a car, right? If someone brings a car in, you're immediately thinking about all the little components of the car and why is the car making this sound and why doesn't it go when you press the gas or why doesn't it stop when you hit the brake? So a mechanic doesn't think about a car like a car. They think about it like thousands of things all bolted and glued and welded and screwed together, right? Which makes sense if you want to fix it or modify it, then you have to get more detailed. And so you can do the exact same thing with the psyche. You can say, I, me, my psyche, my mind, something like that, one thing. Or you can look at it as a whole bunch of parts all kind of operating together like a car or a computer. And so if you look at it as a multiplicity rather than a singularity, then like the mechanic, you can do stuff with it that you can't if you're viewing it as a single entity. So if you are determined to view your car as a single entity and it's not operating, then you have to buy a new one. And so there's benefit to getting refined and detailed when we're looking at a person's personality or their mind or their psyche, whatever you want to call it. So I want to just offer that first of all. The
Love
best
that.
Way to to get at this, David, is to think about when you're trying to make a really difficult decision and you're debating in your mind. And so if you're taking the unitary view, you would say, I'm debating with myself. I'm debating whether to quit my job, divorce my spouse, move to another country, something like that. And I'm just, it's really preoccupying me, all this debating I'm doing with myself. That would be how you would say it as a singularity. If you were looking at it as parts, you would say, well, I've got these parts and they're arguing in my head. I've got a bunch of parts that say this job sucks and I should walk off the job tomorrow. And I've got these other parts that say, what are you crazy? This is where you get your income from and da, 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 da. And they're arguing all day and I can't think straight. Equally true, but if we're trying to get specific, more useful. Does that make sense, David? So that's the parts thing. Voice dialogue and internal family systems therapy and psychosynthesis and gestalt are all systems that view the psyche in this way and then start to get interested in what these individual parts are up to and to create relationships with them. Internal family systems therapy, because you're right, it sounds like family stuff and it did come out of family stuff. It actually came out of family systems therapy. Because what they found was that if someone, let's say little Jimmy was acting out and torturing the cat, and so they would put Jimmy in therapy and little Jimmy would get better and little Sally would start torturing the cat, which made them think, well, wait a minute, it's not just little Jimmy, there's something going on in the family system. So that's why when they send the kid to therapy often they say to the parents, and you guys are, you know, get your butt in here too, because they come to understand that there's stuff going on in the system and you have to deal with everybody. Otherwise, the thing that's going on just moves to another person, like in the old Star Trek episodes when the alien jumps out of the one guy and goes into the other one, rah, you know, like that. So what they eventually realized is those parts that were floating around the system, the same thing was happening in one individual. And so they took the family systems techniques and way of looking at things and applied it to an individual. And that's how they came up with that particular version of parts work. Voice dialogue and psychosynthesis and gestalt got at it different ways. As you can hear, my dog's very excited about parts work. So, so these are all just different systems that either there's probably some that were based on others or something like that. I don't know all the history, but they either independently or being children of one another all arrived at this view of, oh, let's look at it like this. By the way, a neurolinguistic programming has a whole parts work technology that they teach as well.
Fantastic. And what exactly is voice dialogue? Because I, when I first read that, I thought, oh, that's learning how to speak better. But I think it's really more about the internal dialogue that we're having and the voice in our head.
So voice dialogue is one of the systems for talking to parts. And in that system, what happens is, let's say I were the coach and you were the client, David. We would decide which part we wanted to talk to. And you would get up and physically move to another chair. And while you're in that chair, you would talk as if you were that part. Let's say we wanted to talk to your inner critic, for example, the part that tells you that you're ugly and stupid and no one should hire you and this sort of thing, right? So we say, okay, good. So David, go sit over there and you go sit over there and I say, hi, David's inner critic. And you say, hi. And then I start talking with your inner critic about you. And if the person just sort of fakes it for 10 or 20 seconds, it kind of just kicks in. And then pretty soon that part is talking out of their mouth and they're listening to it, right? They're still conscious and going, oh, that's interesting, right? And so now they get to hear this one part of their psyche get to talk, whereas normally it's sort of the aggregate of all of that using our mouth, if you will, unless we're very upset and then one part takes over. But anyway, so now we're talking to that one part of you and we say, oh, now let's talk to this other part of you. Let's talk to the part of you that loves freedom. And you go to this other part. Yay, do I have to stay in the chair? Can I move around? You know, and now we're talking just to the part of you that loves freedom, right? Okay. And so usually there's some motive for the session and we're picking the parts based on what it is we want to achieve. But that's what happens. So you wind up with a little kind of panel of these parts. There's the one David seat in the middle, and there's all these other spots where these other parts show up and throw their two cents in on whatever the issue is. And then we put you back in the middle again, and you and I debrief about what all your parts had to say.
Really helpful. Thank you so much for, I learned a ton just in this first 12 minutes, so I love that. So how did you come And I suspect your background and I suspect your six-year-old self at church played a role in this. But how did you come to do all this work?
Yeah, it's interesting. My brother and I, neither one of us had taken any workshops, but we started sort of analyzing ourselves a bit. We were living together in San Francisco at the time. And I had a dream about a little dog. And he said, oh, that's a part. And I said, what do you mean that's a part? And he had actually figured out on his own that the psyche had, that you could think of the psyche as being composed of parts like this, and had started to identify a few based on its own behavior. So I did the same thing. I was like, oh, I see. I've got this, you know, part that's very risk averse. It does all this stuff. But there's these other decisions I make that aren't consistent with that. There's got to be another part. I started to kind of reverse engineer based on my behavior, which parts there might be. And I found like two or three of them, which is not a lot. There's a lot in there. But to just find those independently, that's a lot. And then I wound up in some workshops. I was starting to feel frustrated in my career at Oracle Corporation. I'd worked myself up pretty high and realized I didn't really want to go any higher. And so I started taking workshops with my brother. And one of them, they taught voice dialogue. And they weren't teaching it in the workshop I was taking, but they did talk about parts and they did demonstrate voice dialogue to the group. And the leader of the workshop, a woman named Jody Gold, said in the workshop, all parts serve. And boy, it was like someone just rang a bell. And I was like, whoa, I need to think about that. I was like, huh. I'm very clear that I do not believe that. to the extent that I have parts, there are good ones and there are bad ones. And I want to empower the good ones and get rid of the bad ones. And she's suggesting maybe something different than that. And it was one of these moments where I was just like, some part of me said, that's true. But it wasn't the normal rational part of me. It was some other part. And I was like, okay, I need to pay attention to that. And so I started thinking, what would it be like to walk through the world with the point of view that all of my parts were good? And I thought, I can't get there, but I imagine if I could, that would be really, really cool. And it was really that moment that started my journey. I was just like, All parts serve. I cannot wrap my head around that sentence. That was the moment.
And how did you reconcile that?
Well, I got trained in voice dialogue and in voice dialogue and in internal family systems therapy and in psychosynthesis and in Gestalt. They all take that point of view. And in NLP parts work, they all take that point of view. No such thing as a bad part. Their part's behaving badly, but there's no such thing as a bad part. Every part is trying to help in its own way. Now, you might not like how it's trying to help, but if you think it's trying to hurt you, it's because you don't understand it. If you think it's trying to cause harm, you don't understand it and you don't understand its motives. So you need to do more investigation. That was the point of view all these systems take. And so I had to learn as a voice dialogue facilitator, okay, here's this part. It's an annihilator part. It wants the person to kill herself in this, you know, this client that you're talking to. That's the part's job, is to get her to convince her that she doesn't deserve to live. That's the part's job. So Tim, your job as the facilitator, I'm in training, right? Your job as a facilitator is to be friendly, curious, supportive, interested, and find out as much as you can about this part, and under no circumstances make it wrong for anything. Go. And I'm like, okay, let's give this a shot. And so we would just have to do that over and over and over again, so that a good voice dialogue facilitator, you can plop them in front of a person and have any part show up, like some demonic possession, whatever, it doesn't matter, right? A part that wants to kill their parents, and just say, oh, well, how would you like to kill your parents? Why would you like to kill your parents? How long have you wanted to kill your parents for? How do you think that would benefit Susie if you did? You know, and just get into this whole curious rap with the part, finding all this stuff out. And it's very interesting the effect it has, because the part is not expecting to be treated that way. That is not how the host ego treats the part. And when you start behaving that way, the part's like, oh, well, this isn't so bad after all, is it? Okay. And then they start to open up and share about what's really going on. And then you can get into how it formed and where it came from and all this kind of stuff. And sometimes the parts, having expressed themselves fully like that, will say, you know, I think I'm going to do this a little bit differently, which they would never do if you were attacking them and judging them and trying to get them to change and stuff like that. So the idea is, if you can at least be interested and curious and ideally love the part just the way it is, it will improve in some way, just like a person. And so this, to me, this is the technology of what the ICF says about treat everyone as resourceful and whole, right? That's a good theory, but how do you do that in practice? And if you're teaching something like the gremlin thing, you're not setting the coaches up to treat the clients as resourceful and whole. You're teaching them that the clients have good parts and bad parts, and their job is to help the good parts defeat the bad parts. And now you're a mercenary in an internal war, as opposed to a coach to the whole psyche of the client. And so, I mean, it was a discipline. It took me a couple of years to master. Once I got it, I loved it. And I do parts work with, I wouldn't say all, but with most of my clients. And it's very useful, David. Like, you know, it's often the case, and it's true for me, right? That maybe there's something client wants to do and they're feeling afraid or resistant about it. Okay. Now you can sort of Nike just do it, rah, right? But that's difficult. I find it much better to say, okay, let's find out which parts those are that are resisting, find out why, and get in there and negotiate with them. See what we can work out, right? And I asked my clients to do some pretty outrageous stuff. I don't know how they would do it if I didn't help them get in there and deal with the parts of them that don't wanna.
What would be an example of outrageous stuff?
Well, I work with CEOs and politicians and folks like that, folks who are like trying to transform their country. You know, I've got one sitting head of state, pretty excited about, government ministers, people like that. And so they're up against very large systems and sometimes have to go to speak to an audience or on TV or whatever and say stuff that they wouldn't normally say, because that's what'll really work. And they're understandably nervous and uncomfortable about that, you know, and so we have to find ways to work through that. Or, you know, we find their higher purpose, and now their higher purpose is to transform some system or other, and they're nervous about that. And now they have to deal with whatever resistance they have to fulfilling that purpose and transforming that system. Like one guy, his company, their mission is to transform the oil and gas industry. It was his mission personally first, and then we did purpose work with the company, and the company actually independently came to the same conclusion that that was their purpose. You know, so they're going to big oil companies and talking to them about stuff that people don't normally talk to big oil companies about.
So it sounds like you're helping people have conversations that they might not normally have. Are you finding these heads of state, CEOs, how are they different from ordinary humans, or are they?
They're less different than people think. Military leaders, business leaders, government leaders, Hollywood stars, folks like that are targets for a lot of projection by the rest of us. And so people will take their unresolved parental material and paint it all over whoever. And so they don't look anything like what they are actually like in real life because of all of the projection. So I'll often be in rooms and people will say, oh, well, those military leaders, da 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 da. And I'll say, well, how many of them have you met? And the answer is zero. And I'm, well, then how did you come to the conclusion that that is their intention or their desire or something like that? And the person doesn't really have an answer. I just know, you know, and basically they've made it up. And so there's a lot of that going on. I will say this, that there's a difference between business leaders and government leaders that's interesting, which is the government leaders are much more fearful. And I understand why. So business leaders are trained to take risks. That's part of their job. And so they're understandably nervous about taking risks like the rest of us, but they get the value of risk taking. And they understand that occasionally you have to do this and you have to do that. Now, unfortunately, the ones who are running really big public corporations are much more risk averse. The whole having all the stockholders and the market analysts and the Sarbanes-Oxley in the US and all this kind of stuff breathing down their neck, they become very risk averse, and those executive teams become extraordinarily political in an unhealthy way, unfortunately. Privately held companies, interestingly, much less so, especially family run ones. Government leaders are terrified all the time, from what I can tell. And that's because all they have to do is say or do one wrong thing and their political career is permanently over. It's just absolutely, I mean, they eat their young. It's a dog-eat-dog, very unhealthy system that they operate in, and they're just terrified. So that's what I would say, David. But as human beings, they're not that different from anybody else. I would say they have greater needs for power or attention than most people. But other than that, not much different.
Yeah, what's interesting that I am thinking about in a slightly different way is you talked about business executives in a private organization distinct from in public organizations or in government. And what I think is in common to all those things is the amount of people judging you.
Yes, which, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Which to some extent may also be the amount of people projecting onto you.
Yeah, because people will project onto you and then judge their projection as if it were you. And you get to be blamed for whatever their dad did or said, or you know, yeah. it's kind of harsh. And I actually gave a TEDx talk about this in Israel about how we train our leaders to be toxic. Because if we wanted better leaders, we could have them. We'd have to place different expectations on them, and judge. I mean, they should be judged in a sense, right, on their performance and this sort of thing, right? But we'd have to judge them differently than the way we do. And it would require a lot more maturity on our part as an electorate in order to kind of induce better leaders out of our leaders. It would be fairly straightforward, but we have to change first.
Yeah. So given, I'd say, if nothing else, the climate for politicians, government leaders, executives, that judgment projection paradigm has only gotten worse, not better. Yeah.
Well, and there's unfair negative projections, but also unfair positive projections that people imagine that Trump or Obama or Bibi or whoever is going to save X, right? Going to change Y, going to move things forward or move things backwards or something like that, stuff that's really beyond the capabilities of an individual to do. And then get horribly disappointed when they don't. So there's unfair positive projections as well as unfair negative ones.
Given the increasing intensity of this climate, has anything changed in how you work with these public visible leaders? And what is your strategy given that condition for working with visible public leaders?
Most of the leaders that I was working with have left politics, which is a bummer for me because I'm trying to groom these people to go transform their countries or whatever. And often when they do get into a really powerful position, they often don't have that much time for me anymore, which is also a bummer. So what I'm doing now is, which is something I was doing before and have done successfully, is groom someone to take over, but I'm trying to set it up in a way where he's going to continue to want to work with me after he's running his country. Actually, there is one country, I can't tell you which one, where I might have a shot. It could take a while, but I might have a shot of having like the president and the prime minister both be clients of mine, which would be a beautiful thing.
That would be awesome.
That's a long shot, but wish me luck. Israeli leader will not work with because they have extreme parts. Israeli leader you find it's hardest to make progress with. So my standard for that, I don't discriminate based on beliefs, which most people would. I had a buddy who was like lawyer to the dictators' families. Right, there are certain families that run certain countries, and he would like help them figure out where to put their money and stuff. And he and I were talking about coaching these people. I was so excited. People were like, well, why would I? Gaddafi was high on my hit list. And they were like, why would you want to work with Gaddafi? He's terrible. I'm like, well, okay. So if you only deal with these kind of enlightened Western democracies, what percentage of the world is that? So we're trying to change the world, but we're only going to deal with 30%, or is it less? I mean, it's not that much. I mean, if you think about China and Russia and all these countries, it's like you add that all up, a lot of the world is living under autocracies, right? So we got to do something with them too. We can't just ignore them and assume that it's going to get better. Good luck with that. So I don't care about the belief systems. What does matter to me is psychological health. And that's because I'm not a therapist and I'm not qualified to work with dysfunction and pathology. I do all sorts of wild stuff in people's psyches, like including dealing with core wounds. We all have core wounds. That's not a sign of pathology, right? We all have trauma. That's not a sign of pathology. So when I discover someone is psychologically unhealthy, then I have to decide if they're really psychologically unhealthy and diagnosed, I stop working with them typically. There are cases where they're properly medicated and I get permission from whoever is treating them. And then I'll go ahead and do it. I just did that with a client recently. He's taking anti-anxiety meds. And I said, here's an email, forward it to the guy who prescribed them. And if he doesn't say, yes, this is cool, we're done. So like that, because I'm a coach, I'm not a shrink. Right. So psychological health, that's a big one. The other one is, and this is just for me personally, if the leader doesn't have an itch to change the world, I'm the wrong tool. I'm not here to help them get more votes or take over this or do that for its own sake. It's about creating heaven on earth. It's about changing the world. And so if they have that impulse, what I call a change agent, great, let's go do it together. Otherwise, it's just not going to go anywhere.
I'm taking so many notes right now.
So does constant fear have an effect on people's health? Research says yes. It stops your digestion, shuts down your immune system, bad for your brain.
How as coaches, you know, I'm just thinking about the role we can play because, mm-hmm. you know, if I'm a young person, I've got three young men who have aspirations, one of them quite political. And I'm thinking, why would anyone, a young person, enter politics, which is really what we need, right, to continue to evolve from where we're at, knowing the current mental state? And is there anything we can be doing as coaches to support and hopefully transform some of this? Because that's kind of a terrifying reality you stated there for me.
Yeah, I would say yes, but coach and mother are not the same thing.
Oh, of so course. Yeah, no. Yeah, and I don't coach my kids, but not. It just stands out as something, you know, absolutely. Those that have that aspiration.
So the thing about the political system is so the people who get into politics, in my view, almost always get in with a desire to change or improve the system. And I don't care which political party they're coming from or anything like that. Very, very few of them don't have that as their primary goal when they enter the system. The problem is the system is super efficient at co-opting people and transforming them into itself. So it eats change agents is the way I put it. That's its food. So you can, every 2 years here in the US, we send a new batch of Congress people to Washington who are saying, I'm going to go change the system. And people are cynical about that. I'm like, no, actually, I think they're sincere. I think they really do want to. I give them the benefit of the doubt. And then they get there and they're like, okay, great. So now sit here. Now make these phone calls to get money from donors. And oh, no, we don't vote that way. We vote this way. And pretty soon they just get sucked in and converted. And as the electorate has determined, the longer people stay there, the greater the risk of that is. It's not certain, but the greater the risk is that they've been taken over by the Borg and absorbed, right? And so how do you set people up to do that? Well, there's an Achilles heel that all these people have, which is they have a need for approval. They have a need for validation. They have a need for this, which is why they're getting into politics in the first place. Now, in and of itself, that's not a problem. If they didn't have that need, they wouldn't be interested in getting power, right? So the question is, how do we as coaches help the people who have a strong power drive, who have a strong need for attention and validation, who are drawn to that world, get a healthy enough ego that they can't be absorbed by the Borg? That's how I look at it. Right? Those needs aren't going anywhere. But if they could be much more conscious of them and where they came from, and to me, the parts work are really helpful. Now they have this power drive part, and I'm like, let's go talk to the power drive part. Woohoo! All right, power drive part. Where did you come from? When did you first show up in this person's life? Oh, well, it was when they were two, And they were, all the other kids in their preschool ganged up on them. And I said, that's never going to happen again. Oh, okay. And now you can, and the person's hearing all this, right? So now you can start to see what the psychological underpinnings are that gave rise to this. Now, this is all perfectly normal human ego development. But if it remains unconscious, it remains co-optable by the board. And so how do we make all this stuff conscious so the person can have a healthy relationship to their own power drives and engage with, in an effort to gain power that's not just an unconscious wound-driven thing? Where do we have hopes in terms of changing the system? If the newbies always get sucked in, how can they always? Yeah. So part of it is understanding how systems work and understanding how systems change, right? If we taught more of these people how that works before we send them off to Washington or wherever, then I think they have a better shot, right? And so there's sort of collaborative leadership stuff and non-hierarchical stuff that's being experimented with in business, but not really happening in government. Government's several steps behind business in this regard. And there's a lot of people, John Mackey, Willis Harmon, who have made the case that it's business's job to transform society because it can. And that if we're waiting for government to do it, we're going to be waiting a long time, because government's a less healthy institution psychologically than businesses. It's more wounded. Likewise, religion, less psychologically healthy, more wounded than business. And business has most of the power, but business also evolves very quickly. It's designed to evolve, right? So in a lot of ways, having these big corporations that can throw their weight around that are more powerful than governments is to our advantage if those corporations are behaving in a purposeful way. So this is part of why I do like finding the purpose of companies and stuff like that, is if enough of them start to operate that way, they will force the governments into line because they can.
So it sounds like what I'm hearing you say is where we have some hope is working with our business leaders.
That's right. That's the easy lever point. I like to do the government leaders too, because somebody has to. I like the challenge. But helping business leaders have a healthier ego and greater self-awareness as they work their way up through the ranks and gain more and more power, that's a relatively easy game to play. And there's a lot of appetite for it and understanding of its need. There's a lot of talk in business about operating according to a higher purpose and taking stakeholders into account, all that kind of stuff. That's all gotten normalized in the last 10 years. And so none of this stuff sounds weird to them anymore. It does to the politicians, right? So when I start talking about the purpose of countries and stuff like that, they get all cross-eyed. But intuitively, they know that I'm right, so they don't argue with me. But they just, oh, it's not possible. And I'm like, well, I hope I'm right and you're wrong. And so I think helping business leaders be more self-aware, helping business leaders in particular be more self-aware about their power drives and their need for attention, validation, and power and where that comes from in themselves, and how to kind of indulge those needs in a healthy way, I think that's the pressure point, right? If we can do that, it'll move things in a positive direction much quicker than a lot of other interventions we could do as coaches. And
if you're helping them become more self-aware and you're helping them understand their power drive, is that sort of inoculating them a little bit? Like I'm talking about younger leaders coming into politics. Is it sort of inoculating them a little bit to the environment so they're kind of aware, I'm going to hit this roadblock and I need to be aware of it? This is where I could have this.
Well, I go further than that. I say the system is going to try to seduce and co-opt you, and here's how it's going to do it, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Right. And so you have to be prepared for that. And here's the thing. And this is now we get into the sort of good part, bad part thing, which is if you think about how ego and power drives and hierarchy and stuff like that are talked about in our world as coaches, those are all four letter words, right? Those are all bad things. And what we're doing, if we do that, if we agree to that and say, yeah, ego's bad. Yeah, self-interest is bad. You know, selfishness is bad. Need for attention and esteem and all that stuff, that's all bad. What we're doing is we're agreeing to make certain basic human needs wrong. If you think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, there's that whole layer of esteem needs, right? We are herd animals. Like, unless you live in a cave somewhere, you care about how certain other people feel about you. That's just how it is, right? Now, is that a problem? Well, it can become a problem depending on what you do with that need. But the fact that you have that need isn't inherently a problem. It actually means you're a psychologically normal human being, right? Maybe if you meditate enough and become enlightened someday, you won't have that need anymore. But short of that, or some other, you know, catastrophic psychological event, that need isn't going anywhere. So now the question becomes, if that's normal, how do we treat it as normal and fulfill it in a way that's not harmful to us and others, right? I could get food in a way that hurts you, and I could also get food in a way that doesn't. And you're kind of hoping I get my food in a way that doesn't hurt you, right? I don't eat your kid or whatever. So we expect people to take care of their own needs, and we expect them to do it while minimizing the harm to others. That's just a normal social expectation. And what I'm saying is, if someone has power drives or a need for a much larger than average amount of attention or something like that, then I wish them all the luck in the world meeting that need in a way that doesn't cause harm to them or others. And as coaches, I would say, if that's your client, then part of the job is helping them to figure out how to meet those needs in a way that doesn't cause harm to themselves or others. Yeah, so if someone's drawn to politics, it's like, okay, great. So you have power drives, you have a need for attention, da, da, da. Otherwise you wouldn't be called this way. Let's make that stuff conscious. And let's talk about how you're going to meet those needs in a healthy way, healthy for you, healthy for others, healthy for the system. And let's talk about how the political system is going to try to use those needs against you to turn you into these people you don't want to be, and how we're going to inoculate you against them.
You don't want a surgeon that doesn't have an ego, because otherwise right. They couldn't do what they do. And you don't want a politician who doesn't have a power driver. They're not going to put themselves through what they have to go through to become a politician. But putting
that's
them
right.
in a
they would never put up with what we do to them unless yeah. they had pretty extreme power drives.
But you're showing them how to do that in a way that they don't become unethical and go down a path that they can't come back from. So I think it's right. It works brilliant. Thank you right. for
and just to circle back, this is all coming from that all parts serve thing that Jody Gold and Carol Kamen and you know all the, my voice dialogue teachers, bless their hearts, told me, which is, okay, that's how it is. Could you love it? Could you make it right? Could you figure out how it serves as your default reflex instead of trying to figure out what's wrong with it as your default reflex? Okay. Yeah, I think I can do that.
I imagine there are some parts that are obvious to us and many that are not. So I'm wondering, like, what is the best way for people to discover all of their many parts? And I'm just kind of thinking about like William Taylor's work on authenticity, where you really only learn about yourself through the dialectic. And then mm-hmm. you have people maybe like Nietzsche, who want to shun society and traditions, and especially Christianity, and Thoreau, who, you know, removes himself from society and really does that internal self-reflection work. Right. So I'm wondering what you
found. As soon as we're trying to remove stuff from society, we're back into the good parts, bad parts, right? Because Christianity is a collective part, right? Just like the United States is a collective part and business is a collective part. Right, those are parts of the human psyche. And so that raises the interesting question, you know, I like to challenge myself on this, right? Can I look at the Tea Party and these Trump guys are giving away some of my political views here? Can I see them as a collective voice and ask myself, how does this serve, right? Or the KKK or something like that. Okay, another part. How does this serve? How can I do that parts thing I do with this part? Oh boy, all right, that's gonna take a little work, right? So just side note on that. So I'm sorry, what was the first part of the question?
What is the best way to discover our many parts through dialectic or something else?
So what I find is a practical matter, because we have to engage our clients in doing something that they see as valuable enough to want to spend time on it and do their homework and pay us and do things like that, right? So because of that, I find the easiest way and the best way to get people started on this is to pick something they care about and say, okay, so I want to address this issue that you don't know how to address. You hired me to help you address. We're going to address it using parts work, right? So you really want to leave your husband and you're terrified and you can't get up the courage to do it and da 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 da. Okay, let's talk to the part of you that wants to leave and the part of you that doesn't. All right, now we've got two parts just out of that issue, right there. And there's usually, if there's any energy around the issue, there's usually a pro and con faction of some sort going on, and often several parts on either side, not just one, right? So now by the time we're just done interviewing that parts, the person's mind is already blown. Oh my God, I have all these parts and I didn't know about this and I didn't realize that and this kind of thing. I knew about that part of me sort of, but I didn't know that it came from that, right? When I was four. And so now they're like into it. Right. And so now the next time an issue comes up, it's very easy to enroll them and say, okay, let's look at the parts that come up around that. And that will get you a long way. They don't have to be like interested in exploring parts for their own sake to want to do that. And then I start to teach them how to talk to their own parts. Turns out to be easy to do in writing, right? Where you can, they write a dialogue back and forth with the part. I start to teach them about how to talk to their own parts. And now they're starting to get into it on their own. The big one I'm looking for is that when the day comes when some new issue pops up and their reflex is to start talking to their parts about that issue. And I'm like, yes, success, right? It's that teach a woman or teach a man to fish thing, right? Now they're starting to do it themselves. So I find that to be most useful. Then if they're into it, then we can start doing a little more probing and poking around and in the unconscious and stuff like that. Because you're right, there seems to be no shortage of parts.
Thanks, Tim. A reminder to all of you to go back and listen to our conversation with Daryl Davis from several months ago. I think it's an example of loving parts in action. He talked a lot about his work about connecting with KKK members and having them shift what they were up to in a very productive way. So it's a good reminder of that as well.
It's about a year ago, actually.
Yeah, about a year ago. Wow.
I know.
This is all very fascinating, loving it. And I, as you were talking about the political scene, it reminded me of a conversation our group has had in the past few months about the word power in general. Mm-hmm. And out of that, for me, is the word courage. Because when I have worked with senior leaders trying to do change within a system, it is a political journey.
Yep.
And they say, in order to do that, it's going to take a lot of courage for me to do that. Mm-hmm. And I am wondering if you could talk to us about how parts work, uncovering for a person to even be able to say, I have a power drive, when that word is sometimes not a welcome word. How do you turn that into courage to actually move forward with what they've discovered in their dialogue?
So what I tend to do is I tend to focus on the parts that are afraid. Some of that might be because I'm a six on the Enneagram, so I kind of naturally drawn to the downside. But so I focus on the parts that are afraid, and because they're usually the ones that are blocking. And so they want to do something in the system, Janet, that's going to be good for the system and potentially good for them, but requires a lot of courage. If they're saying, wow, that's going to take a lot of courage, translate, I'm afraid, or at least part of me is, right? So, okay. And then the part of me that's afraid is resisting the idea of me doing this. And so now if we go talk to the part that's resisting, I want to know what are all the things that it thinks might go wrong. And what would it need in order to be able to green light the operation? Like, what would have to be true for it to say, yes, okay, I'm still maybe kind of nervous, but let's go ahead, right? So that's the approach I take. Because then in my view, it's sort of like you're trying to move the car, but the wheels are chocked, right? There's like stuff blocking. And so you can rev up the engine and try to drive over the chocks, and that might work, and you might hurt the car when you do it. But it's easier and safer to remove the chocks and then drive the car. And often, by the way, often this is an important one that people don't think of. They think, oh, you're resistant to doing X. Sometimes the part that's resistant has a really good point.
Yeah.
And the thing it's afraid of could really happen. And it would be wise to have a plan to figure out how to avoid that or what to do about it if it comes true before proceeding. And afterwards, you're thinking, oh, wow, I'm glad that part was resistant. And I'm glad we talked to it because we didn't have a plan. We hadn't foreseen that potential negative outcome and we didn't have a plan for it. Okay, now we're ready to proceed, right? that happens all the time. And it's just interesting, as coaches, I find that we tend to be biased towards willingness over resistance, for example. We tend to be biased towards transformation over staying the same, for example, right? And it's like, okay, that's fine, but let's be honest about our bias and not pretend that we're neutral. And note that sometimes that bias causes us to miss stuff. Maybe now's not a good time for the client to change.
I love your analogy of the car with chocks. So let's name the chocks that are holding your wheels and work around those and deciding whether or not you even want to remove those, because now may not be the time to do that. So that's cool. Thanks.
I think the best book that I know of is Embracing Ourselves by Hal and Sidra Stone. They're the creators of Voice Dialogue. But I want to warn you that none of this conversation nor that book will give you sufficient skill to have people pay you money to talk to their parts. And so if you want to play, you can play with your own, knock yourself out. Right? But if you want to have people pay you money to talk to their parts, you need to take some kind of professional training in voice dialogue or internal family systems therapy or NLP parts work, if you're an NLP person. One of these systems and get, and because a lot of them have familiarization courses, that's not what you're looking for. You're like, I want to take the facilitator training. What's the facilitator? What's the one that after I'm done with that one, then I can confidently go out and start talking to other people's parts and know that I'm not going to do any damage, right? That's the thing to do. And we at the True Purpose Institute sometimes run courses like that too.
So there are courses out there that talk about this kind of stuff, sort of. Some of them use that language of saboteurs. And yep. I know you've started to talk about that, but if you can go a little bit deeper into, like, if you're trying to get rid of your saboteurs, why does it matter to not use that language of saboteurs?
So we've got basically these two camps, the ones I've been naming over and over again, like the internal family systems therapy, voice dialogue, NLP parts work, who all subscribe to the theory that all parts serve. No such thing as a bad part. And then we've got these other ones, which do what is actually a more obvious and understandable approach, which is to say there are good parts and bad parts. How do we empower the good ones and get rid of the bad ones? And I'm saying absolutely unequivocally that camp two has it wrong. That as soon as you start identifying bad parts that you want to get rid of, you are setting up a war inside the client's psyche. And it's a war they cannot win. Because the parts that are criticizing them and telling them they suck or that they should kill themselves or whatever are doing it for a very good reason that they have forgotten. And those parts started doing it when they were 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 years old because they told them to. They told the part to do that. They don't remember telling it to do it, and they don't remember why. But the part is determined to fulfill on the charter that it was given when it was created, even if the host ego is trying to annihilate it or get rid of it. They will not flinch. They will keep going no matter what. And so now you have, you're exacerbating a situation which naturally exists, which is judgment and conflict between the various parts of the psyche. And what I'm saying is, no. We want to teach the client how to love all of their parts and create a groovy collaborative team in there. But we're not going to get there if our first move is to decide which parts are good and which parts are bad. If that's our, I mean, imagine the first day of class in a school where the teacher says, okay, before we start learning any material, we're going to figure out who the good students are and who the bad students are. And then we're going to start to learn. Think about you as a student, what goes on in your mind when that happens. Like, holy crap, we're going to what? Are you now in a learning mode? No, your amygdala just fired big time and you're not ready to learn anything. So it's a terrible intervention in my view.
You know, it reminds me, and just one quick last comment about Sybil and the three faces of Eve and all that split personality stuff. Yeah, thank
you. That's right. Now that's a different situation. Often when people start learning parts work, that's an early question they have is, do I have multiple personality disorder? Which, by the way, is now called dissociative disorder. And the answer is, we all have multiple personalities. We don't all have multiple personality disorder. And what distinguishes the normal functioning of parts from the dissociative dysfunctional functioning of parts is actually in the handoff. I actually had a woman in one of my parts classes who revealed at the end of the class that she had dissociative disorder. I was like, just about panicked. And she was like, no, Tim, everything's fine. It was great. I got permission from my therapist. Da, 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 da. She had a fabulous time in the course. And she talked about the experience of having dissociative disorder. And what happens is, and this is in the movie Sybil, I remember it, which is when you switch from part A to part B, the handoff is bad. And part B doesn't know what was happening before it took over. It's sort of like in those science fiction films when the guy would get projected into some person at some point in the past or something like that. And he shows up and he's like driving a car and like, oh my God, wah! Like this. It's like the part just shows up in the middle of things with no context and no memory. And now it's gets handed the baton and go. And it's like, I don't know what's going on, right? Normally, as we switch from part to part, we have a continuity of a sense of identity, a continuity of memory as we go. So you're driving down the road and you're singing to yourself and having a great time. And then you see the red and blue lights and you pull over on the side and you're like, here you go, officer, right? Different part, but you remember singing 3 minutes ago, right? You're not feeling that way anymore, but you remember it and you think that was you and you think this was you too, right? That's what happens with dissociative disorder is you get these abrupt shifts with no continuity. So it's like different egos handing off from one to another, not different parts handing off.
So here's the question. If saboteurs don't exist, right, how does one catalog what?
No such thing as a bad part.
No such thing as a bad part. We often hear the phrase, you should focus on what you're good at and not what you're bad at. Develop your strengths. So do you kind of diminish those parts that you don't personally think are so good and amplify the ones you think are good? Or is that not taking advantage of the parts?
That's more of the same. As soon as we're starting to diminish parts, they must be in the bad category, or else why would I be trying to diminish them, right? So that's just a recapitulation in my view of that same good part, bad part thing. Yeah. So I've found that emphasizing the strengths is a beautiful thing. But I've also found that trying to strengthen the underdeveloped areas is a beautiful thing too. So for example, as I was kind of out of the box shrink wrap designed, my facility with emotion was extremely poor. Now, if I had just focused on my strengths, I would be a mathematician or a computer scientist, and I would have great trouble maintaining an intimate relationship with anybody. So I would say, no, actually there's value in going after the underdeveloped stuff too, if there's a reason to, right? If it's causing an issue and I want to develop in this area, great. And now let's find some maybe less powerful, less conscious parts that don't have as much sway in the psyche, but if they had more, they could actually help me in that area, right? As opposed to saying, oh, we're going to diminish that stuff, right? So I think both have value, and the question is in service to what, right? We're coaches, there's supposed to be a goal. What am I trying to do? And so one of the things I do with some of these like politician clients is I've got one guy who I'm grooming, and he's got this very strong pleaser part. And I'm like, okay, so that's going to be a problem, like, because that's your Achilles heel that the system is going to use against you right there. Now, are we trying to get rid of the pleaser part? No, we are not. The question is, how can the pleaser part help? How can the pleaser part evolve? How can the pleaser part be part of the team rather than a liability? Right? It's sort of like if you imagine on a football team or something like that, where you're changing someone's position to something else where they're going to do a better job, as opposed to kicking them off the team. So think of these parts like the ego is sort of like a CEO, and you've got all these employees, but you can't fire anybody. So if you want to get as much value as possible out of all these employees, you have to train them and find suitable jobs for them and encourage them and stuff like that so that every part is contributing to its maximum capability. If you don't do that, it's going to find something to do and it might not be what you want. So give it something useful to do.
It's so interesting. We often hear you have dogs and they're bored. They'll just rip furniture up. But if you give them a job, they're happier. Are you saying the same thing? Because that can sound a little demeaning in a way.
Well, not all part systems do this. Voice dialogue doesn't, for example. I don't think internal family systems therapy does. But the way we teach stuff at the True Purpose Institute and also NLP parts work, we actually do transform parts. And so the trick is, because remember, we're not judging the parts as bad and wrong. So we have to approach it from a point of view where the part's transforming because it wants to, not because the coach or the client wants to do. The client's eager for the part to transform. They'd shoot it if they could. It's like, no, we're not doing that. Okay, maybe we can lower its power. No, we're not doing that either. And they're like, what are we doing with this horrible, terrible part? We're going to put it to work. And so what we do is, I'm not trained in the NLP version. I've seen it once years ago, but I can't speak to it with any authority. In our system, what we do is this clever thing that this guy, Jeffrey Van Dyke, came up with, which is where we actually find the higher purpose of the part. And it turns out that usually the part's normal behavior is the exact opposite of its higher purpose. And as soon as the part sees that, it wants to transform. This is irrespective because it doesn't care about the problems it's creating for the client. It's just doing its job. So, okay, but now if the part can see, I'm supposed to be achieving this and I'm actually doing this, that doesn't work. Now the part's interested in and open to completely rewriting its job description and doing some utterly different job in the psyche. So a inner critic will frequently become some sort of coach, right? Once it realizes what its purpose is. A wounded child could become anything. They do all sorts of interesting stuff. They might become a party planner or a fun-loving part or all sorts of different things. One of mine's like a strategist, sort of figuring out how to solve impossible problems. So they turn into all sorts of wild stuff. And if you do that, what you're actually doing is all these parts are fundamentally fear-driven because they were created out of a negative event of some sort. And so they're always trying to avoid something, which means the whole psyche is kind of fear-driven to a large degree, unconsciously, and that most of the decisions we're making to avoid anything happening that resembles something bad that happened when we were a kid, even though we don't remember it. And so as you switch these parts from fear-driven to purpose-driven, now the whole psyche is moving towards something instead of away from something. And the reason we got so deep into the weeds on the parts work is the True Purpose Institute, not surprisingly, our stock in trade is finding people's purpose. But we found that it was very difficult for them to manifest that purpose because their whole psyche is naturally fear-driven and avoidant. But if we transform these parts, now everything is sort of oriented towards and geared around this higher purpose that the person has. And it makes it much easier for them to manifest the purpose and gives them the courage one of you was talking about before, which is it's like, okay, now changing this system is more important to me than preserving my image. And I'm pretty sure I can change the system and preserve my image at the same time. So let's do it.
You mentioned the word grooming before. Can you say a little bit more about what you mean by that?
Well, again, if we're dealing with these politicians who are going to be headed into this maelstrom of toxic psychological environment, I'm trying to create a very strong, very healthy ego structure that can withstand that and stay focused on their purpose and actually have a shot at making meaningful change in the system that they're in. And so that's training and grooming from my point of view.
Got it. And perhaps basic question, but I think useful. How does psyche fit together with ego, fit together with left, right brain, personality, and parts?
So there's a lot of different models of whatever you want to call this thing. And I don't want to try to speak authoritatively to all of them, but there's sort of general agreement that there's a conscious and an unconscious or subconscious, right? Which would be the stuff that we're aware of and the stuff that we're not. Shadow, unconscious, subconscious. To me, they're all rough synonyms. Some people like to slice and dice it more than that. I could care less. So we're necessarily dealing with the conscious bits, which I call the ego. And ego in the Latin sense of I, it's literally the word for I. And so that means when I say I want to do this, the I I'm talking about is necessarily my ego. Now, I unconsciously might want to do something else, but I don't know about that. I can only speak to the conscious part, right? So to me, the whole conscious aspect of this whole thing, which I'm calling the psyche, is the ego by definition. And so to me, that's not a bad thing, right? If you had no conscious individual sense of self, it would be pretty hard to drive a car, for example. I had an enlightenment experience once, and it was like throwing a Frisbee was like very strange. And I would not have operated a car in that state. So this is the operating system. It's our belief that we're separate, right? Maybe we're all one, but it's our belief that we're separate that allows us to do things like make decisions or set goals or operate heavy machinery. So that's not a problem from my point of view, nor, as I said before, is our desire to meet our own needs also not inherently a problem. So that's sort of the conscious, unconscious piece. And there are conscious parts and unconscious parts. There are parts you know about. Do you, like when I say inner critic, how many of you can go, yeah, I know what you're talking about, Tim. I got one of those. Right. That's a part that's usually conscious to people. You can hear the negative self-talk in your own brain. Right. But then there are other parts like a wounded child that I mentioned earlier. Some of you might know about your wounded child from doing a bunch of therapy or something like that. Probably some of you don't. What's he talking about, wounded child? Right. That's typically unconscious until you do a bunch of work to uncover it. So there are conscious parts and unconscious parts, conscious thoughts, unconscious thoughts, conscious feelings, unconscious feelings, conscious intentions and goals, unconscious intentions, conscious beliefs, unconscious beliefs. Big old mess, right? And we're just putting these different lenses like parts or beliefs or emotions or ideas or something or conscious, unconscious over that big piece of muck to try to make sense of it. Everyone who studied this stuff says there's at least 10 times as much unconscious stuff as there is conscious stuff. Make of that what you will.
If love is the antidote to fear for all these various parts that are flopping around in our brains,
I know several people who say the answer is yes. I'm not convinced fear needs an antidote because fear is an emotion, and feeling all of our emotions, in my view, is a healthy thing. It is true that fear can get carried away with itself and shut down our cerebral cortex and make it hard to achieve certain things. But I'm not on a path to try to get rid of fear. That's another good, bad, in this case, good emotion, bad emotion game. Right. And I'm not playing that game, as previously noted. So the question is, how does fear serve? When does fear serve? Like I said before, sometimes you're afraid of something because it might happen and it would be bad. And that would be a useful signal. Right. So if you had no fear at all, maybe you'd walk in front of a bus and get killed. I don't know. But I'm not convinced that fear is the problem. I think it can become a problem, but so could love. I mean, talk to someone who's dealt with a lot of codependency and stuff like that. It's like, well, you know, we can get carried away with just about any emotion to a degree or in a way that makes it toxic.
Very good. So the next question for me and our last question is, what's your learning edge today? What's on your frontier? What's on your horizon? Where are you going next?
Yeah, so I revise my purpose every few years, keep it fresh. And lately, it's asking me to go after countries. And that makes me nervous, brings up some fear. And so I've been dealing with the parts of me that have reservations about positioning myself as a coach to countries and finding the higher purpose of countries and doing activities like that. It's kind of a natural progression. And I've had like information from my higher guidance since like 2009 that it was going there. Now it's actually becoming possible. I've got two countries I'm grooming, to use that same term, which, by the way, in the political parlance now is a very bad word, but potential client countries as opposed to client organizations or client individuals. In one case, to find the higher purpose of the country. In another case, to deal with some really problematic, toxic parts and fear and stuff that's going in the system and driving the country off the rails. And so a lot of my inner work now is dealing with my very normal, very natural, everyone has them, fears of taking my purpose to the next level, fears of being a messenger, fears of being more seen, all that kind of stuff. That's where I'm working now.
One of the things we're going to talk about in a little bit is that we're continuously thinking about how do this group of coaches expose themselves to a wider and wider audience. And as you've confronted your own fears along the way and done work and gotten exposed and getting hired in really, really interesting places, what's been important to you as you've expanded your work in a purposeful way?
I think that question's a little too broad for me to answer. Everything I've done is about expanding my purpose ever since I found it 19 years ago. And so it's all either about manifesting that purpose, getting more clear about that purpose, or removing the obstacles to manifesting that purpose. And that's led me on a path of ego reformatting. Like, if, okay, the car works really well for this, but now we're going to put it on the racetrack. So we have to make some modifications, you know? And so a lot of this is about who would I need to become in order to be able to do that?
That's really helpful, because we talked earlier this month about, as you think about where you want to go in the future and where your practice is at a very practical level, we said, you got to figure out what you're up to. What do you really want to accomplish? What are you really doing? And I think many people skip that step and they just say, I'm doing this. How do I do more of it? And I think, as you've just illustrated, getting clearer about what is your purpose, checking in, is that still my purpose? Do I need to upgrade it? Do I need to make it bigger, different? And then using your car analogy, which I think is so helpful, is does this car serve that purpose, or do I need to modify the car, add an extra set of wheels, bigger engine, different shape, different color, whatever? And I think all of those steps are really what's tantamount to helping you more effectively have the world know who you are and what you can do for them as well. Is there anything that you have intentionally done or not done as you've been expressing your purpose in the world that would be helpful for us to know?
I would say, yes. I would say this. If you're really clear about your purpose, then you face a choice in your marketing. And the choice is, do I go public with what I'm really up to? Or do I position myself as a slightly more generic coach, use more businessy type language, and hide that initially and then reveal it later? And let me say, that's a potent dilemma for people in our profession. And there's no right answer. There's pros and cons. The pro of wearing it on your sleeve is pretty much everybody you work with is going to be into what it is you're into and want you for what you're really good at. And the marketing people would say, you know, narrowing your niche is a good thing. And so when I say, well, I only work with leaders who are called to change the world, that takes 90%+ of them off the table immediately. But if you're a leader who is called to change the world and you're kind of frustrated with your coach who doesn't get that, I suddenly start to sound very interesting, right? So it's being specific is an attractor for those who meet that specificity. But that makes people nervous to tighten things down like that. From the people I know who run in what I call stealth mode and use the more businessy language, they get to do the stuff that they really like to do with about 10% of their clients. That's the trade-off. And it's your life, it's your money, it's your purpose. You get to decide.
That's really beautiful. I think that's a really interesting expression. Getting very specific makes people need to find you in a way that's really helpful. And you can go up, or people can go up or down to get to where you are. If you are a more generic person, maybe you spend 10% doing what you really love. That's it. Really, really interesting way to frame that in a really powerful way.
Now, you have to find a way to say your purpose in a way that's meaningful to someone who wants to hire you, right? The fact that you want to change that world in that way isn't necessarily going to draw them in. But if you start with that as the basis and try to clarify what it means to them and do it, like an example of that would be a phrase I use is, I guide leaders to create heaven on earth. That would be an example. That's my elevator pitch, right? Mm-hmm.
which I love because it creates immediate conversation. Like, well, how do you do that? Or what's heaven on earth look like? I mean, there's two or three
fantastic which is what questions. An elevator pitch is supposed to do.
Exactly. Gotta spark interesting conversation, but it also illustrates very clearly in what 8 words, what you really do and what you want to do. Last on purpose, do you find our purpose or do you uncover it?
The majority of people believe it's already there. And if that's the case, I don't know that there's any difference between finding and uncovering. Either one is a process of discovering something that already exists. There's somewhat less than 50%, I don't know, 25, 30, 35, it actually varies from country to country, interestingly, percentage of people who believe that the purpose is a choice, that you get to choose your purpose. And in with those people, the either find or uncover makes no sense to them at all. It would be like finding or uncovering your career. No, I choose my career, right? I wanted to do this, and so I did. Or choosing a goal or choosing my values. Like, those are choices. So for those people, purpose is exactly the same. I choose my purpose. And they're very resistant to the idea that it would already be set for them. So if you're doing purpose work with people, I almost always start with that question. So I know which terminology to use with the person. Are we looking for it or are we creating it? Which are we doing?
Deborah, you were so gracious to bring Tim to our dialogue and conversation today. You've been paying attention to this work for a long time. What are you learning today? What are you taking away from this session?
Thank you so much, Tim, for joining us today. That very first piece that you said about all parts serve and the pieces that you talked about around the difference between government work and business work and the relative greater health in business. As someone who actually never wanted to work in the business world when I was young and idealistic, you've helped me understand why I've been drawn to the business world as opposed to government, which I used to think I wanted to become president, and then I quickly disabused myself of that notion. Being able to hear you talk about this from a zoomed out place has been fascinating. And I'm just so thrilled and appreciative and grateful that you've joined us today. Thank you.
Thank you. Really fascinating questions, David, that have elicited more detail than I was imagining. And a sophisticated audience too, with good questions. So
yeah, I think we all learned a ton today. I'm certainly leaving here thinking about a number of things. Certainly, I think all of us that have done work on ourselves are constantly growing and developing. As Deborah said, that simple thing that all parts serve is a really, really, really helpful frame. You then have to do the hard work of saying, well, how does this icky part actually serve? But
right. If I'm not going to get rid of it, if I'm not going to diminish it, what am I going to do exactly?
Yeah. Is it boring it okay? Or give it a bigger place? Tim, I know you've got a call in about 5 minutes. We so appreciate you getting up early and spending time with us.
This is one of my country grooming clients. So it's very important to me. wish me luck.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it. Be well.
Thank you all.